Keith reconstructs the social networks, social divisions, and global connections that fueled this mass peasant rebellion. In doing so, he also develops a sustained critique of methodological nationalism and the tendency of scholars to read categories of the present back into the past. Quite simply, it is a fascinating work. When I read it a few years ago, I actually had to stop at some point and the thought burst into my head, wow, Keith just made peasant studies sexy. Some of you might have felt that peasant studies has always been sexy, but to somebody who was sort of new to the area, I was resoundingly impressed. And if I'm not mistaken, today's talk will pick up some themes from Loyalty Unto Death, if as Keith described, it's less an offshoot of that project and rather something that's mushrooming out in its own fashion. The description of Keith's research that I provided here is, of course, just the tip of the iceberg. He has numerous brilliant essays that range from topics such as labor migration and empire, post-socialist transition, and state sovereignty. But when I stand back and think about Keith's scholarship, I realize that I'm continually impressed and inspired by his ability to hone in on the ethnographic, often some detail or event that others would likely overlook, and from this engagement to produce theoretical insights that often challenge received truths and scholarly fads alike. I recently read of the late Marshall Solins, who was Keith's dissertation advisor, that he urged his students to ascend from the abstract to the heights of the particular, right? To ascend from the abstract to the heights of the particular. Time and time again, Keith has demonstrated just how powerful and intellectually stimulating this ascent can be. I suppose, though, that you all might like to hear from Keith himself. Today, he will be speaking on Whose Gun Is This? Notes from the North American Ottoman Arms Trade. And without further ado, please join me in welcoming Keith Brown.
Thank you, Andy. That was very, very nice. What a nice welcome back to being in person. Just want to check, can people in the room hear me? And anyone online who is listening, can you hear me? Yep, okay, thank you, I see a thumbs up. So I hadn't actually realized how predictable and stuck in a groove I am, because this paper will also, do all the things that, will try to do some of the things that Andy was talking about, so combining particular and abstract, and I didn't know that quote from Marshall, so thank you. I'm very grateful to Sarah for inviting me, very grateful for you to be here. We did discuss beforehand just now, I think the thought I had was I had something quite polished and nice and finished to present, and I realized in the course of this last week that I didn't, and so this is very much a work that I'm looking for feedback on and direction on. So I hope that we can have a good discussion afterwards. And I've asked Andy to cut me off in order to allow us to do that. So just to start with, see if I can get my slides back up. Yeah, so just start with this title. For those who don't know Adela Paeva's wonderful documentary, Whose Song Is This? Or Whose Is This Song? This is an homage to that. If you haven't seen it, I strongly recommend it. Paeva hears as she's at a table in Istanbul with a group of fellow anthropologists and scholars from around the Balkans. They hear a song. She instantly recognizes it as Bulgarian. Everyone else at the table from different Balkan countries recognizes it as theirs. Paeva in the movie confronts and arguably provokes divisive claims of exclusive ownership as she then tours around the region in the movie. And I take this as an inspiration to explore how to re-enter a world that we can think of if we use terms applied to the Athenian Empire in the 5th century BC, the Ottoman Arche. It's constituted out of relationships and investments that extend beyond the region, as it turns out. And so we use that data from that 19th century experience to reflect on how we can understand more about empires in transition from the traces that that Arche left behind. So I have six sections in the paper, and as I said, Andy's going to cut me off. So I won't get to speak about all six, I don't think, in detail, but I hope to give you enough of a sense of the paper that and the sections that we can have a conversation afterwards. So I want to start with three points of departure from three sources that have guided this research. And the first is from Raymond Jonas, who wrote a wonderful monograph about the Battle of Adwa, where an Ethiopian army led by Emperor Menelik II defeated invading Italian forces. This took place in March 1896. In the introduction, Jonas notes, among other things, that one of the strands he followed, the ways in which Greeks, Armenians, Jews, and Swiss, in his narrative, all sold arms to Menelik. This, he suggests, confounds our understanding of imperialism as a coordinated enterprise of statesmen, soldiers, and merchants. His close attention to this dimension of Menelik's statecraft and success, including an extended discussion of the entrepreneurial efforts of French modernist poet Arthur Rimbaud in arms smuggling in a period of his career, seems to represent a contribution to a set of theoretical approaches coming out of philosophy that I've been hearing a lot about already at the Collegium that is under the banner of the new materialisms. And one exponent of this, a political scholar, Diana Kuhl, offers in a 2013 article, which I can give the reference to, it's very accessible, offers a roadmap of the key components of new materialism in her mind. And this includes attention to the what she calls the irreducible imbrication of human and non-human, or natural and social processes, and to the near continuous interfolding and reconstitution of assemblages that temporarily take the shape of entities, structures, and objects, but which are always in the process of becoming rather than in the state of being. She argues in this particular article for the practice of what she calls a capacious historical materialism, which in her view, quote, must integrate detailed empirical fine-grained studies of micro-level phenomena with attention to intermediate structures of political economy and broader macro-level systems. And just a side note, it turns out we've been doing this all along thanks to Marshall Sahlins and others, but it's when it comes from other disciplinary backgrounds as well, I find a sort of fresh eye on the same challenges. And then the third point of departure comes from the work of Anne Laura Stola, an archival historical anthropologist and also politically engaged scholar. And in particular, her call to complement or complicate studies of empires by emphasizing instead, or using the term imperial formations. That concept recurs across her work, and she acknowledges her debt to Raymond Williams in the formulation, and the value of the term in a number of places, including an article on imperial debris, which I'll come to later. But I focus here on the different glosses she offers in a 2006 article in Public Culture on degrees of imperial sovereignty, which was prompted in part by public and scholarly discussions of the time of US government policymaking, rhetorics, and self-perception in those early years of the Iraq intervention. Stola offers two partial interpretations or glosses of imperial formations, and then poses a question that makes clear the shift she's advocating. And I have that question here. What if the notion of empire as a steady state that may rise or fall is replaced with a notion of imperial formations as supremely mobile polities of dislocation dependent not on stable populations so much as on highly movable ones, on systemic recruitments and transfers of colonial agents, on native military, on a redistribution of peoples and resources, on relocations and dispersions, on contiguous and overseas territories. So these are three different kinds of call for disrupting over-schematic accounts of history and the agency that drives it. And my particular interest is in putting empirical research to work, in particular, making larger sense of a disparate set of micro-level phenomena over the, and this paper focuses, or this project focuses on the period of around 1870 to 1885. There's a newspaper, a sort of foundational and steering newspaper account of this these set of processes that I'm examining, published in 1941 in the Providence Journal with the title, When Rhode Island Armed the Turk. We can discuss the various essentializations the journalists use later. Concretely, though, the story is around a contract between the Providence Tool Company of Providence, Rhode Island, and the Ottoman Empire, the Sultan, to produce 600,000 modern infantry rifles for the Imperial Army. A significant proportion of these 600,000 rifles was delivered in time to be used in the Russo-Turkish War of 1877 to 1878, where they captured wider international attention for their impact. So there's a kind of one way of telling this story, which is the Providence Journal's account in 1941, which is, look, nobody knows about the story. The second one, which stems from that, is a kind of giganticism, which points out this is the biggest single foreign contract obtained by a US arms company in the period. It made the Providence Tool Company the largest employer in Providence for a number of years. And the rifles produced were, for a short time, identified as the most effective infantry weapons in the world because they kill at longer range faster than anything else available. So that's one narrative frame for this set of events. And so it's fairly clear why a Providence-based journalist would be drawn to it, especially as in that 1941 article, he was able to interview two of the daughters of the president of the Providence Tool Company at the time, who secured the contract, who directed the company's expansion, and who traveled with his family to Constantinople, where he received a decoration from the Sultan. And the prospect of salvaging more of the story and telling it even greater detail, especially for historians, also motivated Jeffrey Stewart as a master's student at Brown University in the early 1970s, when he tracked down the family archive and put the story in the context of the New England arms industry writ large. And I don't know if Jeff was able to join us today, but he's now working as a retired lawyer on a book on this project as well. So almost 50 years on, though, from that master's thesis, which stands as the sort of one of the more impressive pieces of scholarship on this sequence of events, I want to explore what more there is than the opportunity to fill out or fact check more details and dimensions of this story. And for me, the enterprise has value that I've already cashed in on, as Andy alluded to. Before learning about the phenomenon of new materialism, I was already an enthusiast for the ordinary language approach to transnational and global history, which after George Marcus and my colleague Ian Cook is simply called Following the Thing. Ian has built on that principle a larger project which emphasizes experiential learning and action research on commodity fetishism, empathy, and inequality in contemporary supply chains. And in that work, he engages more closely with science and technology studies, especially actor network theory, and with philosophy in the spirit of Jane Bennett's Vibrant Matter in particular, which again is another sort of key text in the new materialism movement. And inspired by that, Ian has encouraged his students to imagine supermarket aisles as filled with the constant murmuring of the objects on the shelves, and considers it part of the impact of the ideas that he has students coming back saying, yes, they can hear them. So I'm a much more pedantic and less poetic operative. So I came at this from an interest, as Andy said, in the social and cultural dimensions of insurgency and very, very pedantically, how exactly the Macedonian Revolutionary Organization went from six young guys meeting on the waterfront in Thessaloniki in 1893 to an armed uprising with 20,000 people and 20,000 soldiers in the field 10 years later, in the face of imperial repression and subversion by neighboring national movements. So tracking the route of rifles described in those Macedonian archives back to Providence was an important piece of the story I wanted to tell. And I laid that out in one of the chapters in Loyal Unto Death, where I was trying to enter the world of early 20th century Macedonia and make sense of motivations and mechanisms without invoking easy assumptions about nationalism did it. Right? You can get 20,000 people in the field because they're Macedonians and they want to fight for Macedonia. I wanted to dig past that. But it turns out that identifying adjectives are much stickier than that presumes. So I'm interested here, who's in the title, whose gun is this? I'm really interested in the national attribution of the gun, or the imperial attribution of the gun. But I'm also hoping to persuade you there's more at stake in this story than for people who aren't necessarily interested in late Ottoman imperialism or Macedonian nationalism, or the Providence arms industry, but there's still value in testing or expanding the real world purchase of engaged theory using empirical material that is in and of itself incomplete, fragmentary, or orphaned, but that is somehow simultaneously stubborn and elusive. And so, as you'll see, I'm trying to make a virtue out of incompleteness in this paper, in the sense that what you'll see in this project is that any kind of aspiration to get the whole story and every dimension of it, even in the age of Google and open archives and transnational travel, is folly. And is kind of absurd because we don't really need that much detail to tell a convincing story. What I'm trying to figure out, hoping that you can help me, is, well, how much do we need, given that we know telling stories with no empirical detail at all is not very interesting? Aspiring after all the empirical detail there is and waiting until we've got it all is also not productive. So whereabouts in the middle do we think we can find the stopping point? So there are gaps and elisions in the material I present here, and I hope that we can discuss my claim that the lure of completeness, while seductive, impedes the work of expanding the interdisciplinary imagination and the work of connecting knowledge in the world. So I want to start very concretely, and when I say start, I mean in the middle part here. So you remember I had six parts. So method, sources, and traces is now, we're in method, sources, and traces now. I want to talk very briefly about some of the concrete remains, the imperial debris, if you like, from this sequence of events in late 19th century. So I want to look at, just allude to the memory traces in actually three cemeteries and two museums. So in Swan Point Cemetery in Providence, Rhode Island, within walking distance of each other are two graves from the 1870s. Mahanonde Tefik died 5th of October, 1874, the cause of death listed as pistol shot. And a little to the north of that grave, Hassan Salih, who died 20th of August, 1878. So got 1874, 1878, a few steps apart. In his case, the accompanying record is a little bit more detailed, giving his birth as Constantinople and the cause of death, a gunshot wound to the abdomen. Neither of these records, which you can find through findagrave.com, has attracted any online traffic or evidence of other visits. I haven't been back to Providence since I found these two grave references, and so I can't verify the condition of either site. But the gravestone on the left here is from the Glenford Cemetery in North Scituate. So it's about 13 miles west of that other graveyard. And there is Omar M. Weber, 1848 to 1924. no cause of death given, no indication on the gravestone of what the M stands for. But that's recorded in other traces, and that of his spouse, Sarah, who's buried in the same cemetery, died in 1932, who had the same middle initial as well as her maiden name, Rösler. So the giveaway here, the M is, as you've probably guessed, M is for Mustafa. And that gives you, I hope, the first clue what ties these three grave sites together. The other grave marker here I'll come back to later. More detail emerges from newspaper records that provide glimpses into the professional and more salaciously the personal lives of these three men. They were all members of a contingent of military personnel, Turkish military personnel, stationed in the Providence in the 1870s as arms inspectors. Mahmud Tefnik was a lieutenant, Salih was a corporal, Mustafa was a sergeant. And we know Mustafa's rank because the Providence Journal gave us a list of the mourners at Salih's burial service in October 1878, which gives us the names of about 15 more Turkish officers, commissioned and non-commissioned officers. None of the others have left the same archival traces as these three. And missing from the list of attendees at this funeral was the commander of the contingent, General Hussein Tevfik, actually, who I will allude to now. That is his grave marker on the right, who was resident in Providence all the way from 1872 through to 1879, and then came back to the US as the ambassador of the Ottoman Empire in 1883. So, got four grave sites then. They're tied together by this production process and by those 600,000 rifles. I want to talk about a couple of those rifles that now are in their resting place in museums. So there are examples in Istanbul, Turkey, and in Athens, Greece. And then there are at least eight of these 600,000 rifles between the collections of the Smithsonian Museum in Washington, D.C. and the Imperial War Museum in London. Now, I last fired a rifle when I was a high school student in the UK. It was a bolt action Lee Enfield. And one of the things that struck me visiting these two museums is the difference in curatorial practices in the UK and the US. The UK Imperial War Museum has disabled all of its weapons. So that you can't use the mechanism anymore. And in the Smithsonian, you can. So I actually got to work the rifle in the Smithsonian. It was still working. And I find something quite remarkable about that, that a rifle produced 150 years ago still works. And so I wrote about that one of the first pieces that I about this research, which was in a public facing piece. And I got a pretty dismissive response from the gun community in the US, including one post on Truth About Guns with the onion-like funny title, Slate, which was where I published it, Slate horrified to discover that guns can last a really long time. So I really wanted to get past the obvious, right? And so start with that rifle in the Smithsonian collection to say, well, whose is it? As far as the curator and I could tell from the records maintained on an index card generated at the time of accession, it never left the United States. It was produced in Providence. It first passed into the possession of the War Office in Washington, D.C. And from there, it was accessioned into the Smithsonian collection on July 31st, 1903. And just a side note, I find that in itself really compelling and interesting, which is that it enters museum status in the US 4 days before the Ilinden Uprising in Macedonia, where its cousins, brothers, peers, whatever you like to call the relationship between those many rifles, were being used by insurgents against the Ottoman forces and by the Ottoman forces against the insurgents. So there's a kind of time lapse of when things go to the place they go to die or live forever. So I was, as I said, I was allowed to handle it, and the curator took a considerable amount of time to talk about it and curatorial practices with me. So it's part of public property. That said, I visited before January 2021, so I didn't take the mindset that because it's public property, I could take it and just, you know, treat it as mine. So I don't go that far with distributed ownership. But it belongs to the US people. But on its index card, as I said, it traveled from Providence to DC. It's in an American museum. It was made at an American company. It's mostly out of American materials. And the index card describes it as this Peabody Martini rifle, Turkish. And the index card is like the Smithsonian ethnological exhibits. It sort of records the people with whom the object is associated. And the card says the people with whom this rifle is associated are Turkish. So this is a screenshot from the Imperial War Museum's online record of its rifles. There's one that isn't in the online record that has a plaque bolted onto the stock of the rifle, and the plaque indicates that it's a gift to the to England from Montenegro after being taken from the Ottoman army at the siege of Scutari in 1912. This one, though, is a lot more careworn than the Smithsonian example, which is pretty fresh, and is identified in the online catalog as here produced for Turkey by the Providence Tool Company of Rhode Island, USA. This example was captured during the First World War in Mesopotamia. So in the Imperial War Museum's case, we've got a gift from a small proud nation in one case, and we got a capture from an overstretched empire in the other, but the two rifles end up as part of the story another shrunken empire tells about itself. But in every case along this way, this rifle is identified as Turkish. So let's see now, how am I gonna get through this? So the fact that all of these rifles in US and UK museums with their separable stories now constitute imperial debris in the English-speaking world, as do those grave sites in Providence, is part of my impetus to supplement still further Anne Stoller's query regarding envisaging imperial formations as dependent on relocation of peoples and resources, relocations and dispersions on contiguous and overseas territories. So it suggests that it's sort of flip it and say, well, the grave sites in New England then, in one kind of viewpoint, constitute the traces of Ottoman military presence in the United States. So that, and that Providence, and in particular, the Providence Tool Company's production facility, constitute the kind of exceptional space that is, they become Turkish, they become part of the Turkish Empire briefly, that generated a range of potential futures and variable outcomes for the people and objects which animated that space and which that space in turn animated, gave life to. I hope that there's enough there so we can talk about sort of approaches to assemblages and how we think about that approach or approaches. So I'm gonna put the factory to one side. The takeaway from the section on the factory is a close reading of this 1862 Scientific American description of the factory. And one of the things that struck me reading this 1862 account is that aspects of the new materialism are manifest in the writing style, the attitude of the writer, the relationships that the writer conjures between machines, things, and people, and also animates and similar sort of sentiment to new materialism, trying to provoke new ways of thinking in people reading this article. It's from 1862. There's a series of quotes that illustrate different parts of that argument, but this is the last one. Having described the sort of gone through the assembly of the rifle. So looked at the barrel production, the where the steel comes, iron comes from, etc. There are these two quotes. First, they ask the reader to imagine the process as repeated and replicative, with its own productive capacity generated out of the battlefields where the products are eventually bound. So before this one, the writer says, let us leave the barrels and the rollers who toil and sweat at their arduous labor. They roll all day and late at night, and some one of them will be rolling doubtless years after this article is penned and forgotten. For every bullet fired on the field, there are thousands cast, and every report of a musket calls hundreds more into existence at the armory, until they stand a long row of silent agents of death, complete and fully formed in every respect. Now, what I found completely compelling about this is it starts as a puff piece for the Providence Tool Company and how amazing their factory is. And yet the writer inserts into it this imaginative extension to reflect on the cost of this kind of investment in this kind of business. And of course, this is written during the American Civil War. So the people being killed by these rifles are fighting for the Confederacy, the secessionist movement. But after this sort of call to the reader to think about or to project forward to the battlefield, gender of the writer, goes on to imagine a consciousness, or more accurately, a prescience on the part of the machines by writing the tools on these. So he's now on the part that produces the wooden stock. The tools on these revolve with incredible velocity and produce a sighing, mournful sound, as though they felt reluctant to complete their stint. The tip and butt machines especially gave forth doleful moans, crying out the while they scattered the chips far and wide for the blood that was shed throughout the land and the part they were compelled to bear in it. So again, I feel like what we've got here in 1860s is, in important ways, predicts, anticipates some of where scholarship has come back round to in different disciplines, and in particular to this focus by the science writer who attributes to a machine whose function is limited to making the stock ready for the final assembly, knowledge of the past, present, and future effects of industrial level war as waged by mass armies of conscript or volunteer soldiers, trained and led by officers, supplied with ammunition, most likely by horse, mule, or ox-driven supply chains. And I'll also add the muzzle-loading Springfields, these products here, even though the description of the factory begins by saying how vital to an effective soldier is an absolutely reliable rifle. They, of course, involve human input to fire them. Muzzle loaders in particular, biting open the paper container which contained the powder charge, using the ramrod to sit the ball against the charge, inserting a percussion cap in the lock mechanism before aiming and firing. The writer here vividly articulates both the concept of distributed agency, in which the production machine envisages itself as complicit in the kill chain, and also, in Kuhl's phrasing, refuses easy dualisms, insisting upon the irreducible imbrication of human, non-human, or natural social processes. So all in 1862. So that's the factory. All right, let me talk briefly about the contract. The formative contract. So this section discusses how it was that the Providence Tool Company ended up with this contract, and it involves again a sort of what, depending on our chosen terminology, we might want to call an assemblage, we might want to call a formation, which involved in particular weapons trials being conducted both first in the US and then also in a variety of nations and empires, looking at the American Civil War, recognizing the need to move to breech loading weapons, and all of them then conducting trials to find the best design, ostensibly. So when the British Empire called for, and it also sort of shows the proliferation and the mixing of intellectual capital by gun makers in different places. So when the British Empire called for designs to be reviewed in 1865, there were 104 entrants from different gun makers around the world, of which then 9 were in the final round. One of them was the Peabody, which the Providence Tool Company had gone to tremendous trouble to purchase the patent for and sell or try to sell around the world. One was the Remington, which was used by the US, and the British government ended up mixing and matching. They took the barrel design of the Henry, and they took the firing mechanism of the Martini, and that was the creation of the Martini Henry, which is this iconic rifle in the British Empire in the late 1870s. Turkish Empire decides they're going to follow the British model. And at that point, the Providence Tool Company president flips into entrepreneurial rather than design purity mode and just retools the factory, takes on retooling the factory in order to get this Ottoman contract. It displaces everything else the factory is doing. So the factory was many of the other weapons producers in the US were retooling for civilian markets. So they were switching into producing sewing machines and typewriters. So adapting their machinery and their workforce to do that. Providence Tool Company, after this contract with the Ottoman Empire, drops all its other contracts. It drops a contract it had with a Singer sewing machine company in particular, and just throws itself entirely into this single contract over the next 7 years. All right. How am I doing? Is it about 10 or 15?
About 10.
Okay, thanks. All right, so that's briefly on the contract. Inspectors and intimate relations. This is actually the part that I should have got to much faster, especially if I put sex on the slide, then you would be even more excited about this. So back to these gravestones. So the number of inspectors in Providence between 1872 and 1879 varies from 2 or 3 up to as many as 25 at one point. And there's the general, Tefik, the commander who's there the whole time. There's a major, Major Basseri, and then there's a bunch of these younger folks, of which Omar Mustafa, Hassan Sali, and Lieutenant Tefik, I don't think any relation to the general. These are three of the kind of younger set. So one of the things that's striking is again, is this, as I've alluded to, this sense of very different archival legacies that different kinds of people leave. General Tefik, for example, his correspondence is preserved in the Providence Tool Company archive. He sort of came to Providence as this near ideal of a European cosmopolitan. So he's born in Bulgaria. He had studied mathematics in Constantinople. He had served as a military attaché in Paris. In Paris, he had spent time with the movement known as the Young Ottomans, those advocates for a more republican and more egalitarian rule in the Ottoman Empire. But he was in touch with them, but somehow never lost favor with the Sultan or the leadership in the way that some of those folks did. They were exiled. He wasn't exactly exiled, but he ended up getting sent to Providence, where he spent 7 years. He continued to work on mathematics, publishing a book on linear algebra in 1882. He wrote regular letters and gave interviews that were published both in the Providence Journal and beyond, often advocating for the Ottoman, an Ottoman perspective on international relations. He presented talks at the Rhode Island Historical Society, where he was a member. So as I said, born in Bulgaria, a quietly observant Muslim, he nevertheless displayed the kinds of cosmopolitan and urbane traits that made Providence's more provincial elites, anchored in fledgling industry and the Episcopalian Church, frankly swoon. They loved him. They couldn't get enough of this guy. In anticipation of his departure in October 1878, the Providence Journal reported that the personal and official bearing of the general during his residence here has done much to dissipate erroneous impressions concerning his country and people. And as I said, he returned to be the country's official representative in Washington, D.C. in 1883. And this is his, if Wikipedia is to be trusted, this is his grave marker in Eyüp Sultan Cemetery at the heart of Constantinople, which is where many of the distinguished figures in Ottoman history are buried. Professional military officers of the 21st century might take a different view of Tevfik's leadership if they judged him by the reputation and professional development of those under his command and his care for them. As I mentioned, two other soldiers died of gunshot wounds while serving under his command, and he skipped one of the memorial services. These were, in both cases, I want to talk a little bit about the cases, partly because they're where the press paid attention, so we have sources on them, but also because both were suicides, which involved, depending on your viewpoint, doomed love, pathological jealousy, intense shame, or just sex. So they offer a very different glimpse of the nature of the encounter between a foreign military presence and a civilian population, really sort of mess up the clean production line of just inspectors in town to stamp rifles in order that they can pass the criteria of their employers. So what they do is add to our sense of the places we need to look besides the factory, besides the contract, beside the learned societies attended by Tevfik. We need to look at the economic and affective spaces of the New England urban demi-monde of pawn shops, saloons, carriage rides, and what are known as disorderly houses. So I'll just give you headlines. So the the Lieutenant Tevfik, who shoots himself in October 1874, does so after being arrested and fined for drunkenness with a young woman named Minnie Burlingame. When they were looking into the suicide, he went to a bridge over the river and shot himself with the idea that his body would be carried out to sea. So it was a literal, like, romantic, like, self-erasure that he was doing. When they interviewed Burlingame after his death, she indicated that he had threatened suicide many times, and so she didn't really think any more of it this time. The tone of the newspaper coverage was sympathetic towards Tevfik, who had reportedly, prior to his connection with Burlingame, had been widely known for his courteous manner. So he was kind of moving towards the general's approach, and who had good family connections in Constantinople. Burlingame faced no formal charges, but it turned out that she was sent from the city by the chief of police and ordered not to return. So there's a kind of, we see this different kind of policing going on in the background to this. We can't actually find out what happened more to her case in the US archives. It's not 100% clear to me that Minnie Burlingame was not an alias, just as Tevfik, when they were arrested, gave the name William Jackson to the police. Salih's suicide 4 years later was reported differently. He killed himself in his room in the hotel. And he had already attracted very negative publicity reported in newspapers around the country, because a few months before his suicide, He had got in a fight with his mistress, Dolly May, in her lodgings at Packard's Block. He'd stabbed her twice, and then he had jumped out of the third story window. He broke a hip and two ribs, but survived, as did Dolly May. And then in the inquest into that assault, all charges were dropped. The Providence Journal's coverage is it headlined, "No indictment against the jealous Turk," and notes that Sully owed May his freedom. The grand jury could not find a bill by reason of her singular testimony. That he stabbed her twice with his keen two-edged dirk was evident, but Dolly had no recollection of his striking her, and as in the lower court stated that she might have done the stabbing herself. So his jealousy was apparently caused by her refusal that night to answer his questions about her relationship with another man who she had spoken to on the street. So the investigation of his motives in the coverage suggests that he just didn't want to go home. He didn't want to go back to Constantinople. So it sort of acknowledges the implication is of a deep and desperate emotional attachment to a woman who we know who we from the archival record we know virtually nothing about. So her reported testimony is of someone making a mockery of proceedings by withholding evidence, but she leaves no trail through newspaper or archival records after the death of her devoted lover. Mustafa, I won't talk about more, we can talk about him more in the discussion, but he actually had a similar early relationship with a 15-year-old woman who he married, and then the two of them had various disputes going through the legal record before he then married his eventual lifetime bride. What I want to just flag in these cases is they offer glimpses into the wider pattern of opportunities that these young Turkish men and these even younger New England women saw and seized, and which in turn shaped their lives. The urban environment where they were trying to make their way was strange, threatening, and dangerous. There was little by way of safety net or support network beyond what they could make for themselves. These teenage girls who found opportunities to cross paths with the Turkish officers were often themselves first or generation immigrants. Rusla, for example, was born in Germany. They were finding ways to live outside state surveillance, which they clearly recognized as not having their interests at heart. And one recent study of Providence in this period points out that the category of disorderly house constituted a resource for women who were cut off by societal sanction or by entrenched racism or classism from other forms of livelihood. In the lawsuit that Mustafa directs against a man called Richard Gibbs on the grounds of alienation of his wife's affections, it's striking, and I imagine was no part of what Mustafa imagined would happen, that Gibbs's defense rests entirely on maligning Melissa's reputation, arguing in effect, how can my client be charged with alienating the affections of a woman who's so clearly oriented towards life on the streets? All right, so the last section, which I'm not gonna get to, is ships, rifles, and things of power. I trace the concrete cargoes by which these rifles left Providence and got to Constantinople. And we can sort of see a shift in the way the rifles are treated and the attention paid and the sort of tensions around shipping. First as the Ottoman Empire comes under closer scrutiny in 1876 after the Bulgarian atrocities, where Turkish populations, irregular recruits to the Ottoman Empire massacred Bulgarians engaged in revolts in 1876. And there's a New York Daily Post account that sort of restores that imagination that I posited in that first article in 1862, where they ask they call on the makers of the rifles and the ammunition to recognize that they are actually equipping these irregular Turkish troops who are killing civilians in Bulgaria. That then shifts again when war breaks out between Russia and Turkey in 1877. And there's this extended series of efforts or investments by the Provenance Tool Company and others to conceal shipments, which before they've been sending sort of with full publicity. So there's a case where there's a suspected Russian plot to send 40 passengers onto one of these ships to hijack it en route and take it to Russia. And then there's another case where the Provenance Tool Company's agents conceal that a ship is leaving harbor because there's a Russian corvette that they are worried is going to intercept it and take it as contraband of war. So the category of what these rifles are at this point shifts from part of relationship building with Turkey to first tool of imperial oppression and second weapon of war between countries. And then the very last section traces some of the other rifles through, as I mentioned at the beginning, the initial rifle I tracked down was the one that ended up in the hands of the Macedonian Revolutionary Organization. The Peabody Martini rifle, after the Turkish government declare it obsolete, it travels outwards, resold to Persia, to North Africa, East Africa, Peru, the Arctic, Peru, not Chile, sorry. And sort of ends up in the hands of Montenegrins, Albanians, Macedonians, Persians, Ethiopians, Arabs, and Bedouins. All then, these are journeys from the center of the empire out to its edges in what would turn out to be its last days. I'll read the last paragraph. So like the breakdowns in payments and trust that surrounded the contract, like the deaths and troubled romances of the inspectors, like the frictions in the transport network that this contract called into being, these last movements of so many of these rifles are reminders of the central argument that friction will out. So at one level, this is a kind of anti-theoretical position. There is no grand narrative. But this is, for me, what makes the call for capaciousness by Kuhl and the call from Stoller to recognize the intimate ties by which states of exception do not necessarily or even often throw systems out of gear, but are byproducts of these central systems. But the argument is, by paying attention to what's going on at the margins, we can sharpen our critique of the easy assumptions that blunt the capacity for empathy, and we can see more of the picture than our own interests dictate and our chosen lenses allow.